Hello and welcome back to Silver Age Silver Screen, the podcast where we watch, discuss, and review sci-fi, cult, superhero, and other stereotypically geeky films. I'm your co-host, Casey Jarms.
And I'm your other co-host, Riley Thorne.
And Riley, like, a big part of this show is adaptations.
Right.
Reviewing the film adaptations of things we like. Like, ooh, I like Superman. Is this Superman movie good? Eh. Ooh, I like Super Mario Brothers. Is this Mario movie good? Eh. That's what a lot of this show is. And often we're kind of disappointed because we don't think the adaptations are a good representation of the work they're adapting. Although I should note, there's a lot of shitty comics. We're more upset about our ideal ideas of what the perfect Batman story would be than any actual Batman story. But the point is, a lot of times we see an adaptation of something that we like and we don't like the adaptation because it ruins the thing we like.
True, very true.
This week's kind of different.
How so?
Because I don't like the source material. I fucking hate Ready Player One by Ernest Cline. It's one of the worst books I've ever read. I am genuinely angry about just how that book is written. It's perhaps the worst prose I have ever seen. It's all around an awful, awful book.
Yeah, I mean, love it or hate it, the fact of the matter is the book has become essentially a pop culture phenomenon. It reached a bestseller's level where it's beloved to the point of having a film adaptation be made by one of the greatest filmmakers ever to walk the planet, Steven Spielberg. That said, just because it's popular doesn't mean it's good.
I understand why that book is popular. I understand why Twilight is popular. I understand why Sword Art Online is popular. I understand why a lot of bad things are popular. And oh god, Ready Player One, it's just like, I'm gonna rant a lot about how much I fucking hate that book in this episode.
That can be our intro.
It's just how it's written. That is not a book that should have been a book. It should have been a movie, which, I mean, it is a movie now, and the movie is marginally better. But, like, God, just how that book is written. I mean, the biggest problems are in the themes and the overall arc, but the prose. So, like, the whole thing in Ready Player One is just, hey, remember that thing from the 80s? That works a lot better in film, like the book, how the book is. And anyway, so I was like driving the DeLorean, which was the really cool car from Back to the Future, which was a movie from the 80s that I like. And as I was driving it, I ran into King Kong, who's like that movie monster from the 30s, which is really cool and nerdy. Like, oh god, the book is awful.
I have not read the book.
Don't.
Myself, so I wasn't planning on it. So if I'm understanding you correctly, your main issue with it is just the style of writing.
Well,
and the prose you think is just poor and messy. You mentioned earlier the themes and the overall arc. What's your problem with that, if you don't mind me asking?
Actually, no, I'm not going to go into that, because although the film is a lot better made than the book, it's got the same basic plot that I hate.
Yeah.
So this movie, Ready Player One, let's just jump right into this movie, this piece of trash, more escapist than any isekai, that is barely held together as a film by having a really good director and some phenomenal special effects.
Oh yeah, absolutely. This film was directed and produced by Steven Spielberg, who was able to make an entirely different film called The Post while the CGI was being made for this movie. This movie is so massive in terms of special effects and CGI that he was able to make an entirely different movie with Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep in it while this was being made. This film stars Ty Sheridan, Olivia Cooke, Ben Mendelsohn, Lena Waithe, TJ Miller, Mark Rylance, Simon Pegg, Hannah John Kamen, and a bunch of other people.
Yeah, just read off that IMDb summary.
It's Google, so yeah. The film opens up in Columbus, Ohio in 2045 to the song Jump by Van Halen, which, you know, that's a fantastic song.
Actually, something real quick I'd like to note about this movie. This movie, considering its whole thing is, remember the 80s? The 80s were cool. Remember the 80s?
Yeah.
this movie doesn't have much 80s music. There's like four total songs from the 80s. Most of the soundtrack is just original generic background music, which is odd. This should have Guardians of the Galaxy level nostalgic soundtrack, and it's only occasional.
Very true. I mean, the handful of songs that are great, but the point of what I'm trying to bring up is the song is good. The shit ton of expositional narration that's happening while this is going on, it's less than stellar.
Oh god, yeah, the start of this movie is just endless exposition. And like half of it is stuff that could have just been shown, not told. Like, why the world is really into VR, it says as the person is putting on the VR headset and going into the VR world. Like, I'm pretty sure this didn't have to be narration.
For those of you who may be new, don't understand what exposition is and why it's bad, exposition is essentially a lazier form of storytelling where instead of giving audiences reasons to infer something about characters or story to learn on their own, you're basically giving them the information. For example, I don't know, Aladdin. The opening scene is running away from the guards. He stole bread. And afterwards, he gives it to those kids, I believe. It's been a while since I've seen Aladdin, which is weird why that's the one I come up with. But anyway, and then he gives it to those kids. So through that, through the actions and the plot and what we're seeing, we as the audience can infer that this character, Aladdin, is very intelligent, very quick on his feet, very thrifty. He's able to evade capture. He's a criminal, but he also has a heart of gold and stands up for the little guy and does everything he can to do right by everyone else. Now, that's good storytelling. If that were an exposition, on the other hand, exposition would be a narration going like, my name's Aladdin. I'm a common street criminal, but I fight for the little guy. And it's like, okay, you could have just shown us instead of told us. It's lazy storytelling,
yeah,
is my
like,
point.
Oh, people like this virtual world because it's really cool and awesome. We must have the main character explaining, the Oasis is awesome. You can do anything you want. And like, it's not show, not tell. It's show and tell, which honestly I think is worse than just telling. Like, I get the picture. You're showing me these phenomenal CG awesome places and you're just explaining, hey, the thing you're seeing is cool. Like, yeah, I get it.
Exactly.
So, Wade Watts, our protagonist, our boring, generic protagonist, expositions the fuck out of the beginning of the film. This film takes place, like, half in the Oasis, a VR world created by a guy named James Halliday. This is perhaps the most complex and massive virtual world ever created, which makes the fact that it seems in this film to have been made almost entirely by one guy. Like, I mean, stuff was added in after he's died, but like, this film doesn't get game development. It treats this one genius as pretty much single-handedly programming fucking VR artificial worlds, whatever.
Steve Jobs. Elon Musk.
Oh god, Ernest Cline has to be an Elon Musk fan.
Oh yeah,
like,
absolutely.
He has to be. Just judging by his whole deal, the fact that he made Ready Player One 3 different times. There are 2 other books by him that are the same shit, and they're somehow worse. By the way, check out 372 Pages We'll Never Get Back. It's a much deeper dive into why Ernest Cline is the worst fucking writer ever, and why Ready Player One sucks.
Is it a book?
It's a podcast. It's hosted by one of the guys from Riff Tracks.
He explains what the Oasis is, why everyone loves it, why it was created, how it was created, and then what's been happening over the last few years.
Yeah, everyone loves the Oasis because they live in a dystopian hellhole. Fucking Amazon has slaves. They live in massive stacks of trailers built on top of each other. The planet is burning from climate change. There's mass poverty, and they escape into the Oasis, this virtual world, because it doesn't fucking suck. It's the only thing left in this world that isn't awful, and I have a lot to say about that as we go on.
Some of those apartments apartments aren't even apartments. They're like fucking vans and trucks that they just extended into the air and are now living out
of. The Columbus Stacks are admittedly a pretty nice bit of world building and design. I do like those. But the point is, Halliday, this insanely talented game designer who did what would take like a 300-person team all on his own, after he died, he left behind his will, which contains within it this Willy Wonka-ass quest, where if you can find 3 keys hidden in his video game, you get $500 billion, like all of his control over the Oasis. So people like Wade, they call themselves Gunters, by the way, which is short for Easter egg hunters. And the worst word, it sounds like a slang for vomiting.
It's like the penguin from Adventure Time.
Wade and the other Gunters are hunting for these keys that give you complete control over the biggest company that has ever existed in the history of humanity.
And it's been 5 years since this happened, and no one has ever come close to getting one of these keys. There's 3 keys. What is it? Ruby key, the crystal key, and the jade key.
Yeah, something like that. Over those 5 years, off screen, like, in the book, that first off, there was like 6 keys in the book, and they all had these riddles, which had a lot of time explaining them. They don't even go through the riddles in this movie, they just cut to. Anyway, then we found where the minigame for the key was. Over those 5 years, someone figured out that to get the first key, you need to win this cool race in the Oasis. And, side note, there are like 30 people racing.
Right.
This is a race where if you win it, you get $500 billion. You get 2 Bezos' worth of money. And there's like 40 people racing. And like half of them are only there because they work for the evil rich dude who wants to get the keys so he can be in charge of the Oasis. How is there not billions of people trying to get these keys?
Right, exactly. This is just one of the many leaps in logic in this film. What struck me really early on in this movie is something really funny. Recently, I watched the Chris Nolan movie Tenet. Phenomenal movie. Absolutely loved it. There's a lot of parallels to my viewing experience with that to my viewing experience of Ready Player One.
Wait, I haven't seen Tenet, but isn't it like, oh, this film is so smart and complicated, it takes like 3 viewings to watch it. I can't imagine this film would ever take multiple viewings.
No. Like, let me explain. I think I have a decent understanding of Tenet upon first viewing. I want to watch it again real soon, and I think we should review it for the podcast at one point. But what I'm trying to say is, the reason why I got it well the first time is every 10-15 minutes, or yeah, about every 10-15 minutes, I would pause it and just reassess, like, okay, what is happening? How do I make sense of these incredibly advanced topics in entropy and physics? So I would just every 15 minutes or so just like ground myself, be like, okay, just want to make sure this is what's happening. Okay, we're all aware of that. Okay, good. Keep going. I did that exact same thing with this film. Every 10-15 minutes, I paused it to reassess what's happening. But that's not because it's too complex to catch without doing so. It doesn't have all these advanced physics equations being thrown at you at all times. No, there's just so much fucking information nonstop, constantly thrown at you and crammed down your throat. There's so much exposition and so much storytelling just thrown right at you at all times, on top of the fact that there is an immense amount of visual references to other forms of media like the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, slasher villains, video games, movies. There's just so much, even out of the corner of your eye. Like, oh shit, that's the 1960s Batmobile. That didn't need to be in this movie, but it is, and I caught that. There's just so much information that every like 10 minutes I paused it like, okay, what the fuck is going on? It's just so overstimulating. That was a big problem for me. This movie, and the movie's already really, really long. Like, it's 2 hours and 20 minutes. It took me 4 hours to watch it because I just had to keep pausing to like, what the fuck is happening right now? So that's not great.
We should note, it's not something we're really going to go over too much because it's not super relevant to the plot outside of The Shining or The Iron Giant and Mechagodzilla, who actually have plot roles, but this film It has a lot of pop culture characters because they're in an online world. It's like Gmod, like just everyone's skin is some random pop culture character. Except for the main characters, they have unique skins because that's more marketable. Wade just plays as this Final Fantasy 15 looking generic anime boy. But the point is, this film, I will give it credit. It's very visually interesting.
Oh,
This
yeah.
film is phenomenal in terms of special effects, and through that, you just get these constant cameos of things that Warner Brothers owns. Like, for instance, this big race at the start of the movie that we're kind of talking about right now. You can see the DeLorean and the 60s Batmobile and the bike from Akira. Like, that's cool. And the final battle at the end, just pause at any moment and try and point out all the characters you recognize. Like, hey, that's Master Chief. Hey, those are the Battletoads. And I mean, sure, it's cool. It's cool. It's a cool movie.
Yeah. I will say, however, they cut some corners with the licenses to these characters in very subtle ways. Like, I mentioned earlier that the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles were in it. And they are. They are in a couple shots, in a couple scenes, or at least in the background. But they're not like the good Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle. They're the no one gives a shit, ugly ass Michael Bay 2014 Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle designs. So they're like, oh yeah, those designs are probably a lot cheaper than literally any other design for the
I mean,
TMNT.
I guess.
Also, so they have these characters, but they have like the dollar store versions of them. It was really subtle, really quick. Freddy Krueger was in the beginning of this movie. He just literally was on for a second and a half and got killed. But I'm pretty sure it was not the classic Robert Englund Freddy Krueger. It was the Jackie Earle Haley 2010 shitty reboot Freddy Krueger that looked like absolute shit. Which, at the end of the day, I don't blame them because these characters are only on screen for a couple seconds. So, what's the point in spending tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars, trying to license these characters when you can just spend like a fraction of that for that scene? I get the business behind it. I'm just saying, don't think you pulled a fast one on me. I got that shit.
We should note, well, first off, Warner Brothers has made this film three fucking times, where it's just, hey, check out all these pop culture stuff we own that are cool. Like, Warner Brothers, they can't keep doing that. They did it in the Lego Batman movie, which admittedly was a really good movie because it wasn't as played up. But then they do it again here, where it's just all over, like, we own stuff. We own the Iron Giant. We own Batman. Go watch the films that we own. And then again, they did it with Space Jam: A New Legacy, which is honestly basically the same movie as this. I mean, it has a completely different plot, but my thoughts on it are similar. Like, where it's just, hey, look, we own shit.
I would argue that that also applies to Looney Tunes Back in Action, that Brendan Fraser movie from Looney Tunes
Yeah, but
movie.
that was like 20 years ago. I forgot it existed. Everyone forgot it existed.
I like that more than Space Jam.
Well, that's not saying anything. Space Jam sucks.
Yes, but I think we should review Looney Tunes Back in Action at
Fine,
some
we'll
point
do it
next year.
sometime. So anyway, this big race that is the inciting incident to the plot. Wade is there racing in a DeLorean. Also racing with him is his best friend H, this big tough dude in a monster truck who is very clearly using a voice filter to disguise their voice. It's not subtle at all. And also, while they're like at the starting line, Wade looks over and he sees Artemis, spelled with a three instead of an E.
Hell yeah, dude.
The hot girl who is like really tough and nerdy, and the love interest, and very. Well, the book character's generic, they give her a little more in this, which I guess, but he sees pretty girl and he stares, and it's like love at first sight.
I would like to note two things. One, this pretty girl is an alien anime weeaboo, so,
Well,
you know, he
yes,
kind of
but at the
falls
same
in love
time,
with a waifu.
at the same time, at least she's visually interesting. At least her design
Oh,
is more
she's
creative
visually
than Wade.
interesting.
I hate Wade's design. It's so bland. And H is cool.
I mean, don't get me wrong. It's not like I wasn't digging her design either. Moving on. Artemis drives the Akira motorbike.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because when Akira came out, Steven Spielberg and George Lucas both campaigned to have Akira be given a wider release in the United States because they recognized the incredible film that was made and how more of a Western audience needs to see and appreciate that film. And they tried their hardest to get it a wider release. Unfortunately, they didn't succeed as much as they would have hoped, but it is nice that all these years later, here he is, he's like, yeah, no, this is still worth talking about, and I'm glad that it has an audience. So Spielberg is honoring his best with that.
So anyway, this big fucking race happens, and all of the cars in this race are utterly destroyed, except for the cars driven by the named characters, because plot importance. And there's some well-done special effects on this action, like Artemis does the Akira slide under a semi, and it's fine. At one point, King Kong shows up and starts smashing cars, but something during this scene just felt really, really off to me. Like, it felt just oddly dull and lifeless. And towards the end, I realized it's the weirdest thing. There's no music during this big, awesome race. There's just, like, the sound of, like, the tires and shit. And occasional explosion. Like, there isn't even the generic soundtrack. There especially isn't any 80s music, and it just felt so lifeless. Like, I'm sure it wouldn't have been a masterpiece of a scene if they had any music, but just having no music combined with the fact that there's just so much shit going on that you can't pay attention to any of it, this scene was weirdly empty.
Yeah, I kind of feel that way about the entire movie. It's weird to me that Spielberg, of all people, would do something like this. I mean, I get it. It's a big popular name brand book. And really, you would have to have someone on his level in order to get the funding to license out all these characters and properties. But it's just weird to me that he would do something as artificial as this. Part of me just feels like he just kind of did it to do it instead of trying to tell a really great artistic story, you know?
This is far from Spielberg's best work. It's also weird. There aren't really a lot of, like, Spielberg stuff. Like, oh, the 80s were awesome. Let's just show all the stuff from the 80s. And it's being filmed by Steven Spielberg. You'd assume there would be, like, some Indiana Jones, some E.T., but no, it's all focused on other stuff.
There was some Back to the Future, which he produced.
Yeah. I suppose that's the biggest Spielberg thing, but I don't know. I feel like maybe he doesn't want it just to be like showing stuff from his films, but it is interesting.
Yeah, I guess. Point of what I'm trying to say is I think it's weird that Spielberg would choose this movie to make. Kind of just feels like he did it just to do it, you know? No offense to Spielberg. I love the guy. He's an incredible filmmaker, but this is not his best work.
So anyway, at the end of the big race, and this, they act surprised by it, but from the dialogue, this is a thing that happens every single time this race happens, and this race has been happening every day for years. At the end of it, Godzilla just smashes all the cars, so the race is unwinnable. And Wade realizes this, so he, like, hits his brakes and he stops. But oh no, Artemis is gonna, like, try and jump and get over King Kong. So he, like, grabs her and rips her off her motorcycle and it crashes. And, like, there's a cool shot of them, like, spinning in the air from her continued motion. But also, who fucking gives a shit? She's just random pretty girl, Wade. Stop being a simp. And also, it's not like she's gonna die. If she wants to risk her life jumping over Big Monkey, let her. This isn't really that romantic of a thing. It's a fucking video game, Wade.
And I also would like to point out the fact that Wade doesn't even know who this girl is. He's guessing that it's the famous Artemis, whom he follows her. He follows her Twitch account, which I think, personally, that's really funny. Like, 20 years into the future, Twitch is still, like, a huge popular streaming platform.
I mean, I wouldn't doubt that.
Neither would I.
Especially considering this film's vision of the future, I have a feeling all existing megacorps are just more powerful in this place. And I assume that includes Twitch, which, doesn't Amazon own Twitch?
I don't know,
Yeah, I
probably.
don't doubt that Amazon still controls the world in this. Although I bet the film's version of Bezos is just always sulking about not being the richest dude alive anymore. Or maybe he died in a space crash. We can only hope.
If not Amazon, then Disney. And if not Disney, then Apple or
And
Sony.
honestly, we did the same thing in the Space Jam one, like joking that Disney's this evil megacorp, and it is, but that feels weird in a film that is Warner Brothers at their most commercial, we own everything, bragging. Like, I honestly think Warner Brothers might be more scary than Disney. Disney's a slightly bigger media company, but also Warner Brothers has control over people's internet. If Disney went evil, it would be bad. If Warner Brothers went evil, I think it would be slightly worse.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not arguing with you. I still want to work for those companies, but yeah.
What were we even fucking talking about?
They lost the race.
Wade saves Artemis from dying in a video game. The hero.
And then, without having any reason to trust her, he takes her back to H's HQ.
Ugh.
Oh.
H's mechanic shop, okay? Where H is building an iron giant. Which, admittedly, that's cool, but also, building the iron giant so it can be used as a non-sentient weapon kind of misses the whole point of that film.
Yeah, a little bit. Artemis and Wade flirt for a little bit. Wade goes under the screen name Parzival.
Ugh.
They flirt for a little bit. He pisses her off. She leaves.
Actually, I'm gonna pause now. Let's talk about their fucking flirting and remind the audience that this is a film that a person wrote based on a book that a person wrote, and I don't know if it's copied word for word, but the entire book is like this. The way they flirt is by quizzing themselves on what pieces of pop culture Halliday liked. Like, what was his favorite FPS game? GoldenEye. Oh, you're so hot because you know this guy's favorite video game. And like, it's so much worse because very clearly, all of the favorite stuff of Halliday is just the favorite fucking stuff of Ernest Cline. Like, imagine writing that. Imagine being that person and writing a book where the hot girl hits on the main character by saying that she likes all the things you like, Ernest.
Yep.
Also, at one point, they bring up a joke line from the 70s Superman movie, like Lex's quote, was it? Some people can read War and Peace and walk away without learning anything, while others can uncover the secrets of the universe from a gum wrapper or some shit like that. And they talk about it being like this super deep, interesting quote. I'm so torn on this movie. I mean, I don't like it, but oh God, so many people tried very, very hard to make this terribly, terribly written piece of garbage look good.
And one of those people was one of the most influential filmmakers of all time, so.
Remember when Industrial Light and Magic revolutionized special effects to create Star Wars? Well, they also made this using their skills for good things.
Artemis gets pissed off and leaves. We get some exposition about the big evil corporation led by Ben Mendelsohn's character, Nolan. The company's called IOI. And it's just evil.
Yeah, and I mean, sure,
Yeah,
big
yeah. Oh, yeah,
internet
absolutely.
startup is evil. I'm not saying that's not something that exists very frequently, almost universally in real life, but also they're so blatant, like, ooh, after we seize control of the Oasis, we will make it so you see all the advertisements. It will block 90% of your vision. Wah-ha-ha! Isn't capitalism bad, I say, in this film made by Warner Brothers? Mo-ho-ho-ho!
Well, what's funny is that the bad guy's plan is essentially doing what YouTube is doing right now. So, that's fun.
Yeah, like, the evil bad guy's plan is to win the Easter egg hunt and get control of the Oasis and then fill it with advertisements.
Yeah, they want to create the adpocalypse, essentially. That's their evil plan.
And I mean, that's a shitty thing to do, but also, it's so low stakes. Like, he tries to murder people in this movie. Nolan has people killed so he can make money from ad revenue in a video game.
And this would be after he won the $500 billion stock price to the company.
That's also a good point. If the Oasis is that valuable, so valuable that it's worth literal trillions of dollars, like, the bad guy's goal isn't even to make money. It's to make money and then keep making money. Like, oh god, such a petty, dumb bullshit. And it's realistic. Like, yeah, that is what this type of person would do in real life. But also, we get in the same breath Artemis saying that she hates IOI because they murdered her father, and Wade saying, yeah, they suck because they're gonna put lots of ads in my video game.
I mean, hey, one is worse than the other. Which one is it? That's up to you.
I'd also like to note, it was during that scene, like, where Artemis yells at Wade and it gives a big backstory dump about how her father was forced into debt slavery by IOI. Side note, slavery exists again in this universe. Well, it exists in our universe in the US, but megacorps have slaves in this movie. But her father died in slavery, and that's why she hates IOI and wants to stop them. And that's a much more compelling, interesting motivation than Wade, who has the motivation of, ah, pop culture and want video game to be saved.
That and anime waifu.
Yes, this is the character this film should have focused on. He's so interesting. I briefly mentioned, I understand why people like this. I also understand why people like Twilight. Like, a lot of the success of the book Twilight rests on the fact that it just has this generic, bland main character that the audience can project themselves into. Yeah, Wade is that. And that's not a good character to be the lead in your film. I kinda hate Wade Watts as a character. I mean, he's not awful, but
yeah, he's really not much of one. Anyway.
What is there to like about him? He's so fucking... He's just... I'm nerdy guy who likes video games, and I'm playing this video game, and I don't have much motivation behind that. Halfway through the film, I get a girlfriend, and then I want to save her. Artemis should have been the main character. Wade sucks.
She really should have. Wade goes to the Halliday Journal, which is essentially a museum of every single memory in James Halliday's life that he collected into this one location, where you can see it play out in real time. This is how and why everyone knows everything about James Halliday, because everyone has studied his life and theorized as to where he would keep the clues to where the keys are at. He starts talking to the curator, who is not at all who anyway.
The curator is played by Simon Pegg.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say.
But he's like a CG character, and can I be honest?
Yeah.
I did not recognize Simon Pegg's voice because he's doing a fake voice, so I genuinely was surprised by the twist.
I was not at all. I didn't even know Simon Pegg was in this movie until the big exposition dump in the first 10 minutes where they showed him. I was like, oh, Simon Pegg. And then he meets and starts talking to the curator and I go, that's fucking Simon Pegg.
It's a good thing that I'm bad with remembering what actors sound like.
Yeah, personally, I saw a million miles away. I was about to make a joke. He's very obviously played by Simon Pegg. Let's be honest. The dude's a great actor. Very recognizable voice to me.
Anyway, Simon Pegg, robot curator man, takes Wade to watch some memories, and Wade watches one where Halliday, I have a few things to say on Halliday, where Halliday just turns to the camera and says, I hate rules and the passage of time. Wouldn't it be good if you could just go backwards? Why can't we go backwards as fast as we can while staring at the camera? This movie is subtle. It trusts the intelligence of its audience. What was this film rated?
I think it has like a 73 on Rotten Tomatoes.
No. I mean, I don't doubt that. But like, was this PG-13?
Yes.
It has the violence and there's some innuendo in the scene that would get it that rating. But also, I feel like this film was made for children because
right.
It doesn't trust the audience to be intelligent. There's the exposition we talked about. There's plot points. There's supposed to be these big reveals that the characters figure out. They solve these puzzles, but it's like the puzzle you would give to a first grader. Like, this film does not trust its audience.
Not at all.
And actually, you at home, after what we just said happens, the clue, I wish we could go backwards as fast as we can. How do you think Wade wins the race?
By just driving straight through that big monkey at the
end? No, you see, he backs up. He drives backwards, something that in 5 years, none of the hundreds of millions of people who must have done this race ever thought of.
Nope.
Is everyone in this movie an idiot? I feel like everyone in this movie's universe is an idiot.
Yes, they are.
Yeah, so he wins the race by driving backwards as fast as he can and becomes the first person to get one of the keys. And also Artemis and H and
two other people.
We haven't even mentioned them because they're so irrelevant to the overall plot. Sho and Daito, they're Japanese ninja and samurai friends who aren't stereotypes at all. The five of them all get the key and start working together to find the other keys to save the Oasis. Woohoo!
And that's what gets the attention of IOI and Nolan, because they want control because of their adpocalypse goals. And Nolan hires an assassin named IROC, played by TJ Miller, to go track him down, figure out who Parzival really is. And can I be honest? I thought TJ Miller was actually kind of funny.
Yeah, he's fine. He's a shitty, shitty person, but he's a good bit of levity in this film.
Yeah, he's got some really good lines.
Yeah, he's this intimidating skull monster bounty hunter who's really, really dangerous, and he's just a fucking moron. Like, halfway through his conversation with Nolan, he's like, actually, can you stand on the other side? I slept wrong, and my neck, it's like hurting. Thank you. Also, I'd like to note, it's a minor thing, and I don't actually know if this is what's intended, but can we talk about Nolan's design, like his Oasis avatar design? In real life, he's just Ben Mendelsohn, but in the Oasis, his skin, it's Superman wearing a suit. Or at least, it's this big, big buff guy who has black hair and the S cowlick. Like, I really do kind of like that. Superman wearing a suit, doing evil stuff. It's a good visual metaphor for who Nolan is as a character. Just taking this beautiful piece of art that is loved by nerds and perverting it for money. I like Nolan's design. And maybe I'm looking too much into it.
It is Ready Player One, after all, so any thought whatsoever put into it might be a little too much. From there, Wade tells H that he just has 100k coins in his account now because he won that key, and he just goes out and buys a bunch of seemingly non-important stuff that is never going to make an appearance ever, like the Holy Hand Grenade, or the Zemeckis Cube, or the Catalyst Bomb, you know? It's like, none of that's ever going to make any appearance whatsoever.
God, like I said, this film treats its viewer like a fucking moron. Like, they pass by a bomb and say, hey, that's a bomb that kills everything on a planet. I wonder if that will ever show up again. No, it won't, because we're not buying it. The only people who will buy a bomb like that are people like Nolan. I wonder how this movie ends. After that, Wade and Artemis go back to the museum place to go through some more memories. They learn that Halliday had a girl he went on one date with, but then she didn't go on another date with him, and he always regretted it, and she ended up marrying Simon Pegg.
Simon Pegg plays Halliday's business partner, who he screwed out of a $1 trillion deal.
I will admit, in the book, they're just like pop culture shit. God, I fucking hate that book, and I'm gonna rant about it. There's no real central theme between the challenges in the book. They're just like pop culture thing that the author likes. Like, the way he gets the keys is he plays Joust. He recites the movie War Games from memory. It's awful. But anyway, they do try to make it better by connecting all of Halliday's challenges to his regrets, like screwing Simon Pegg out of a fortune, never dating Kira, being a shut-in. Like, that is something. It gives something, and that is what makes this movie better than the book.
I do think that Mark Rylance does a good job portraying this guy, this character, this really introverted, awkward guy. Mark Rylance does an incredible job.
I'm gonna disagree. I fucking hated Mark Rylance's performance in this movie.
Okay, how so?
He's very good as the wizard, like when Halliday's ghost, is managing the game and acting like a wizard. That's cool, I enjoyed that. But I didn't like Halliday's performance as just normal Halliday. He's like just so over the top and awkward. He feels like the character is autistic, but like Sheldon Cooper autistic, and the writers don't really give a shit about actual autistic people or are just using stereotypes. Like, I really didn't like Mark Rylance's performance. It just felt so cheesy. Oh, he's a nerdy dude. What's the most generic stereotypical nerdy dude we can make?
I think that that was writing more than acting.
I guess, but also he is very much putting out that performance, like someone over his words, like up, not looking people in the eye, and only ever talk. I didn't like.
Very true. You know what? I do agree that I do understand what you're coming, where you're coming from, and to an extent I agree. Personally, I think he did a decent enough job portraying this character.
By the way, this is just a minor moment. It's weird, in this film that foreshadows everything and is very clear, hey, we're foreshadowing. They're oddly subtle with this plot point. When they're at the museum, Wade brings up, oh, he only ever mentioned Kira once in his journals. And Simon Pegg's like, what, that can't be right, let me check. Let's make a bet on it to see if you're accurate. And after checking, he's like, huh, you're right, here. And he like gives a quarter to Wade, and it's like a little, oh, that was a nice joke thing. That's really important to the plot.
Yeah, yeah, that was well done.
And it's subtle. It's a Chekhov's gun that isn't blatantly obvious. It's the only time in that film where something subtle happens.
Right, exactly. That took me by surprise. I said to myself, I feel like that might be important, but it's not blatantly obvious, so it's probably not.
So the quarter's relevant. The quarter comes back and is important. And I fucking hate that book so much. It pisses me off because it's so dumb. The way he gets the quarter in the book is by playing a perfect game of Pac-Man, which is a thing he can do. Wade Watts in the book is a Mary Stew in terms of just how good he is at being a nerd. Like, only 6 people ever have played a perfect game of Pac-Man, and one was Billy Mitchell, so maybe 5. And also, he can recite word for word multiple films. He has an encyclopedic knowledge of the 80s. That character's Mary Sue. Anyway, that's my ranting about the book. Artemis and Wade go on a date to a nightclub because they think maybe that's connected to the clues and the riddles, and it's genuinely a really cool scene.
Yeah.
They dance in this, like, anti-gravity thing where they're, like, dancing while flowing in the air, and it's probably the most creative set piece and cinematography in the film. I actually really liked it. They play Staying Alive, which is cheesy, but it works. And while they're dancing and falling in love, Wade says his real name, which is overheard by I-Rock. Uh-oh. And Artemis is like, what the fuck? Don't say your real name on the internet, because this is based on a book written by a guy who grew up when all online was using aliases and people didn't use the real names. Anyway, a bunch of Sorrento's goons show up to attack them, but they escape by throwing out a Rubik's Cube that can reverse time.
I mean, it's called a Zemeckis Cube, and it's just a Rubik's Cube that goes back in time, like Back to the Future.
But that's not how Back in Time works in Back to the Future.
Not at all, no. Not saying it's good, I'm just explaining what the fuck is going on.
So anyway, after that, I-Rock knows that Wade's real name is Wade. So Nolan, being a normal businessman, does the only sensible thing. He fucking blows up Wade's entire neighborhood and kills dozens of people.
Including his aunt and his aunt's shitty boyfriend, who we had one scene together and we already hated.
He fucking blows up a bunch of people. And Wade survives because fucking Nolan, the moron, did not check to see if Wade was in his house before he blew it up. And Wade gets away and he is rescued by Artemis and her revolutionaries who take him back to where Artemis lives. And oh my God, then we see the horrors. Earlier, Artemis said that Wade wouldn't like the real her because she doesn't look like this in real life. And I have to say, she was right! Olivia Cooke in this movie, she is utterly hideous. She's the most ugly woman on the planet. I vomited every time I saw Olivia Cooke. Like, she has a birthmark over her eye, and it is fucking hideous. It's disgusting. It's so ugly. Who could ever love someone so hideous?
I mean, I didn't mind it.
Okay, so for clarification, that was fucking sarcasm. She has like a tiny, tiny, barely noticeable birthmark on her face and like makes a big deal about how ugly she is over it. Like, you're played by fucking Olivia Cooke. Shut up, you stupid character in this stupid film.
Stupid writer. She has like a barely noticeable birthmark and she acts like it's the worst thing ever. But then the love interest comes in and is like, no, I don't mind it. And then they fall in love because of that. And it's stupid and cheap and cheesy and fuck you.
So anyway, they solve the riddle. I'm not going to go into it. And the riddle leads them to a movie theater where they watch The Shining. Except wait a minute. They ain't watching The Shining. They go into this theater that transports them to the hotel from The Shining. And I gotta say, it looks amazing. It's phenomenal.
This is the best scene in the movie.
We just get H, who's the only one who hasn't seen The Shining, like bouncing from scene to scene in The Shining, getting chased by monsters. And it looks amazing. It's a perfect recreation.
When it started, I was like rolling my eyes. But I swear to God, this is the best scene in the movie. They should have done more like this. Just fun, direct references. They should have just done more stuff like this because this was the best part of the movie. And goddamn, was it so creative and so fun, and I loved it. Are we still down to review The Shining this November?
Yeah, I'd be down for that. Like, because it's winter, but it's horror, so we do it in November.
We're a Nightmare Before Christmas, that bitch.
Yeah, yeah. Although, I feel like this is a good segue into one of my many big problems with this film as a whole. This film, it's about, hey, look at all this pop culture stuff. But it doesn't engage with any of them besides saying, hey, look, that's cool. Like, earlier I talked about the fact that it features the Iron Giant as a weapon because the Iron Giant's a movie that's cool, but also, that's the opposite of the themes of that movie. There's a scene where they go through The Shining, but this isn't a movie about isolation driving people mad or someone you love becoming a monster. It's a movie where The Shining happens because, hey, The Shining's cool.
And it was an 80s movie.
This film, it features a ton of pop culture stuff, but it never does anything with them beyond, hey, look, this thing from pop culture is cool. And that's one of the biggest problems with this. It's not a movie that really understands or engages with any of the things in it beyond having Harley Quinn show up in one scene because that's a pop culture character. Like, that's the level of interest this movie has in the things that it features. And I mean, it's cool, but if I want to watch this big, awesome crossover of all these great movies, I want it to not just be a thing from that movie. If I wanted a crossover with Back to the Future, I wouldn't just want the car from Back to the Future. And that is one of this film's biggest problems.
I absolutely agree with you.
But yeah, The Shining scene is fucking awesome. Like, yeah. This is gonna be an empty, soulless, just, hey, look at that cool thing. At least The Shining scene is cool.
Yeah, and inventive and does something different with it other than, hey, look at this, you know? They go to the ballroom where there's just these zombie ghosts ballroom dancing over a giant pit of hell. And she jumps over to Halliday's ex-girlfriend and asks her to dance. And she gets the jade key that way. So now our heroes have the second key.
So anyway, after that, actually, shit, we forgot this scene. It happens earlier where Nolan, like, meets with Wade and, like, bribes him, like, hey, I'll give you a ton of money if you just let me win. And Wade's like, no, for the integrity of the Oasis, I'm gonna say no.
And it has nothing to do with the $500 billion when you're offering me 25 mil. No, it has nothing to do with that. It's integrity. Fuck you, Wade.
And speaking of Nolan trying to kill Wade, he sends one of his minions, Finale, who is called Finale in real life. Like, is that her name or her screen name? I don't know. And if it is her screen time, why the fuck does he call her Finale in real life?
That's like some Blade Runner shit right there.
He sends her after Wade, and she storms Artemis's compound, and Wade gets away, but Artemis is captured, and Wade is picked up by his friends, H, who is actually a girl. They actually don't explain why H plays as a male character online in the film, so I'm gonna force a trans interpretation onto them, even though that isn't in the book. And also, my god, we get the biggest twist in the movie. Daito and Sho, those characters who are very plot relevant, you'll notice, because we keep talking about them. They're there in H's van, and we learn that Sho is 11.
Dun dun dun!
That character had like two lines earlier. Who gives a shit?
I do find it funny that in the Shining part, he was like, and this just now occurred to me, H was asking Sho, like, is the Shining like really scary? And Sho was like, I have to watch it through my fingers because I'm covering my mouth. She was also asking an 11-year-old boy, so that kind of tracks.
Artemis is captured, and she's drugged back to the IOA base, where they force her into slavery. Wait, what the that's not- So let's talk about the slavery in this movie! The slavery is they put them in the VR game and have them do manual labor in the VR game. It's like if you owed Amazon a bunch of money, so Amazon kidnapped you and made you mine obsidian in Minecraft for a few hours.
Or years.
What?
Dude, this is like that episode of South Park called The Human Centipad. If you've seen that episode, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
I do not.
Kyle clicks the iTunes update agreement without reading it, so now he becomes a human centipede against his will.
Yeah, but, like, this is...
It's stupid. My point is, South Park did it to be funny and stupid. This is actually trying to take itself seriously.
Yes, the horrible slavery of doing manual labor in a fucking video game. Just program a macro to, like, click on things. Also, this brings us to, we haven't mentioned it before, this is full deep immersion VR, where you're like wearing gloves and on a treadmill, and this is a personal thing. I think that that type of VR is kind of dumb. There are specific scenarios where it works, but I wouldn't want it in the biggest video game where I spend 100% of my time. Like, I like being able to hold down a run button and go across the country of Hyrule. I don't want to have to run 10 miles to play my video game. The only reason that this slavery is bad is because they have to physically do exertion in their cells to play this video game.
Yeah.
It's dumb.
And the other thing that I think is stupid is the fact that most of the people don't actually have these treadmills. They're just doing it on the street, which means wherever they walk in the game, they're walking in real life. So these children can just walk in the middle of the street, get run over by a car. How much of that happens in this world is my question.
Just have a fucking button. Ugh.
And here's my question. I think this is a prequel to Repo Man the Genetic Opera. What about you?
Okay, explain.
They started off with indentured servitude and slavery, but then they just have repo men come and take people's hearts out of their bodies. I don't know. Fucking payments, Amazon, fuck you, singing, Paris Hilton's face falling off in the middle of a set. I don't know. Continue.
Nolan finds the last key and he has his minions one by one attempt to get it. The challenge to get the last key, there's just a fucking Atari 2600, and you have to do something with it. I don't know. I mean, I already, when I saw it, knew what the solution to this puzzle was, and no one figures it out for like 2 weeks in-universe. Everyone in this movie is a moron. Set that aside, Nolan builds a big portal around the castle where the Atari is, so no one can get into it unless they destroy the portal from inside. And he's got Artemis in slavery, and admittedly, what caught me by surprise, Nolan, after setting up this portal, he takes off his headset, and Wade is in his office holding a gun at him. He isn't, though. This is still in the Oasis. They hack Nolan, because fucking Nolan just has his password written on his computer that he met with Wade in front of. The bad guy in this movie is a moron. But they recreate Nolan's office and, like, talk to him in it to distract him as they're breaking Artemis out. That was genuinely clever.
That was one of the few good plot points in this movie, I will admit.
So anyway, Artemis gets out of her cell and she says, "I'll take down the portal, you storm the castle and get to the Atari." And Wade rallies all the users of the Oasis by saying, "Hey, there's gonna be lots of ads. Go, like, fucking buy a tank and come here and destroy this castle in this video game." And we get this movie's climactic scene. Artemis takes down the portal and just this massive army of pop culture characters storm in, fighting off hordes, this big war, and admittedly, it's pretty cool. H busts out the Iron Giant, which is dumb. They throw a Chucky at someone at one point. It's cool, but like I said, everything in this movie is kind of empty. At least they have a rock song now.
Can I be honest, though? This entire third act was very, very underwhelming for me. In a few ways, not just based on the ways that we've talked about in the past. The third act feels so out of place. This is due to the script itself. Like, when the fuck did Wade get the tech and the character development to just tell the entire world, "Oh yeah, come win a war and lose everything you fought for over the last few years"? There were a few scenes where everyone's like, "Oh my god, it's Parzival, he's so cool." But out of nowhere, the entire Oasis, the entire planet is willing to fight a war for him? How it was developed in the story just felt so out of place to me. And some of the action was pretty fun, but others I was just kind of like, nah. You don't give a shit about any of the characters, obviously. The actions are very weightless. This entire movie and its plot are really hollow. It's just, I don't know, visually, it had some cool stuff. Like, particularly when Nolan pulls out the giant Mechagodzilla suit. Like, that was cool.
Yeah, Nolan summons Mechagodzilla. Except for, side note, no he doesn't. That's not Mechagodzilla. That's just Godzilla made of metal. That's not what Mechagodzilla looks like. But yeah, that's the whole thing in this film. It's cool, but it's empty. Like, yeah, it is cool to see the Iron Giant and a Gundam fight Mechagodzilla. But also, if you don't have a strong story tied around that, it comes across as hollow. It's cool, there's good special effects, but I'm not going to remember it.
I mean, this entire battle scene is just a lot of gray character, literally visually gray characters punching other generic characters.
That was a weird thing. Like, it's on this snow field and they choose characters that stand out the most, like Master Chief and the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and just pile them back up. It's hard to see what's going on, kind of, in this scene. There's just so much happening, and none of it's super cool.
Though I will say, the Twisted Sister song was fucking amazing.
Yes, we're not.
That was
going
the best
to
part.
It's what they should have. It's infinitely better than the race, because at least there's music. Anyway, all of Wade's friends, one by one, they die. And by they, I mean their characters, because it's a video game. But Wade makes it to the end. He reaches the Atari, where somehow Nolan's hundreds of people, like, coming up with ideas. No one came up with the idea. Wait a minute, this is a big Easter egg hunt. Very famously, the video game Adventure featured the first Easter egg in any video game. Should we play Adventure? Let's play Joust! Like, Wade figures out a very obvious solution.
I mean, yeah, this entire time, while all this is going on, Artemis is running all throughout the IOI war room and compound, being chased. Another thing that I thought was really stupid is when the IOI, the Sixers they're called, when the Sixers die in the game, their chairs, the rigs that they're hooked up to glow red, and they like fall on the ground and have to get into another rig, right? Well, there are multiple scenes where it's like, for example, a laser gets shot in a straight line and kills like a dozen Sixers. And then in the real world, a dozen Sixers in that exact same formation in line get killed and have to reboot themselves. But here's my question. Does that mean that all the Sixers are in perfect formation the entire game?
Yeah, what the fuck was that?
I don't know if you picked up on that, Casey.
Yeah, I'm like, did. I have it written down right here. Like, that's so stupid. Yeah. Like, oh no, that clump of Sixers got blown up because I guess all the people standing in that corner were also standing together in real life and didn't spread out at all in this crazy battle.
It's visually interesting. It is. But if you think about it for more than a second, it's fucking stupid. Also, another thing that I thought was really stupid, there are many points where the characters are in massive, severe danger, right? Why didn't they just take off their headsets and leave the game?
Honestly, even if they don't take off their headsets, it's a fucking video game. Like, it's very important that this fucking monster Nolan doesn't win, but also, there's like big emotional reactions like, oh no, Daito, the most important character in this movie. I'm sorry we keep talking about him, but I just love him so much. He has such a great arc. Oh no, Daito's character died. Who gives a shit? Oh, he lost some progress in a fucking video game. You're acting like this is life or death. You're treating this with the same severity as when people tried to murder you in real life.
It's so fucking stupid.
Actually, on the topic of Daito and Sho, this might be a thing that the movie does worse than the book. Because they're pointless in the movie. They're just friends who are kinda racist stereotypes, and one of them's 11. In the book, Nolan murders Daito, and that's a big ratcheting up of the stakes. And in the climax, Sho's like taking on Nolan one-on-one, and it's avenging his friend. But like, if you remove Daito dying, what the fuck is the point of that character? To be vaguely racist? So anyway, Wade's about to win the final key, and then Nolan does the Chekhov's gun very clearly. Hey, this is a thing Nolan has that he's gonna use. He throws down the planet-destroying nuke, and it kills everyone. Oh, but Wade has a one-up. The coin that Simon Pegg gave him.
The curator from the journal.
Yeah, like, it revives him, and is that Deus Ex Machina? I'm gonna, in this film's credit, they didn't really establish that's what the coin did, or that was even possible, but I kinda like it, cause in old arcade games, you put in a quarter to continue.
In Super Mario games, you get an extra life.
I don't hate that.
Yeah, no, I didn't mind it. I thought it was a lot more subtle than anything else in this fucking movie.
So Wade gets the third key, and he has to unlock the door to, like, get his prize. But oh no, Nolan in the real life is driving a fucking van and trying to run Wade off the road. And, like, Wade's in the back of H's van, and he can't put the key in because the van's shaking too much. And his movements in real life affect him in the video game. Boy, I wish there was a button to push to put in the key.
Yep.
But he eventually goes in and he meets with Halliday's ghost? Question mark.
At first, it's like a program avatar, but then when Halliday tells him, just sign on the dotted line and you'll have everything. And Wade is like, no, this isn't right. That's not how this is supposed to go. Halliday turns back into his normal self and is like, yeah, okay, that was the final test. You're right. You are finally worthy. Which, that I did like.
And because you didn't want 100% control of the Oasis, I'm giving you 100% of control of the Oasis.
Yeah, I mean, I personally liked that.
It's fine.
The guy that doesn't want it is the person most qualified to have it.
But it's not that he doesn't want it. He specifically is like, wait a minute, this is a test where I won't get it if I sign this, so I'm not gonna sign it. It's not him getting it because he didn't want it. He wanted it. He just knew he was being tested.
You know what? You are absolutely right. fuck me.
He's transported to Halliday's childhood bedroom, and Halliday gives him control of the Oasis, and then also tells him the movie's message, which is, you shouldn't go into escapism. Real life is much better than a video game. That's the theme that we built up in this movie. The 90% of it was just like, this fucking world is way cooler than real life! Yeah! If you're going for an anti-escapism theme, why did you make this movie?
Right, exactly. Yeah, so from there, Halliday shows Wade the kill switch that completely destroys all of the Oasis, which I kind of feel like is going to be important in the sequel, Ready Player 2, which is in development, Casey.
Yeah. Although, Ready Player 2, apparently the book's even worse than the first one.
Oh, I'm sure.
But it was also very much made so there could be a film made out of it. Like, Ernest Cline consulted with Steven Spielberg when writing the book so it would be a book that could be adapted.
That does happen a lot more often than you would think. Like,
I know,
there
I
are
know,
certain but... novels, even comic books as well. Like, you know, Kick-Ass? That was made in conjunction with the development of the movie. Like, it was made to have a comic book run going as well as a movie series going.
I know, but like...
ended at 2.
If you're writing a book, not because you want the book to be good or to be successful, just so there is a thing to adapt into a sequel, like, just fucking write a screenplay.
True, very true.
Don't put this crap out in the world, man. So anyway, Nolan catches up to H's van at the Columbus, Ohio stack, and he pulls out a gun and he's gonna kill Wade in front of hundreds of... What the fuck is Nolan's plan?
Yeah.
Murder's still illegal and you're doing it in front of hundreds of people, and he does get arrested, so clearly he doesn't have that much power to get away with things. Like, it's just there so there's some actual danger in the climax, but as a result, it makes the bad guy become somehow even dumber than he has before. Also, even if he killed Wade, that doesn't make you in charge of the Oasis. It would be the next person to get all three keys.
Right, exactly. I guess you're just kind of, it's like that crab mentality. If I'm not gonna make it, you're not gonna make it, you know? Just eye for an eye.
Anyway, Wade's in charge now, and he meets up with the real-life version of Simon Pegg.
Who reveals that he was the curator all along.
Yeah.
And then gives him complete access to the Oasis, whom he is going to share with his friends, who have dubbed themselves the High Five.
And admittedly, yeah, that kind of works. Like, they try to give an arc and a theme to the challenges. I don't know if they succeed, but they try, kind of. Halliday's whole thing was, oh, I regret pushing people away. So Wade runs with his friends. And what changes does he make to the Oasis? He leaves everything the same. But you can't play video games 2 days of the week now. This fixes escapism. Man, people are spending all of their time in this virtual world because they live in a fucking apocalyptic wasteland, basically, where slavery is legal and fucking billionaires are murdering them all. It's mentioned that there were fucking wars over internet bandwidth. Like, oh no, people want to escape into this video game because their lives suck because fucking men like Halliday destroyed the world? Well, that's wrong. Don't try and escape into media when your life sucks. Oh, are you going to do anything to, like, fucking improve people's lives, considering that you're now the richest person in the history of humanity? Are you going to use your massive wealth and power to try and reshape the world so it's a better place so people don't need to rely on escapism? No, I'm just gonna be rich, but, me, this dude worth hundreds of billions of dollars who has a hot girlfriend now, I'm gonna criticize other people for wanting to spend their time on video games instead of real life. Like, real life is cool. I'm sorry, I fucking hate this ending.
Yeah, it's pretty stupid.
Also, the whole film, it's an anti-escapism theme, except this is the most escapist work I've ever seen. This is what pisses me off about Ready Player One, why I hate the book, why I really, really don't like this movie. And I'm sorry, I'm in a ranting mood and I'm kind of hogging the conversation. Like, escapist fiction isn't rare. Like, ooh, you get transported to a world where you're a hero. that exists a lot, but Ready Player One is the most shallow piece of escapist fiction ever. Like, it's not Sword Art Online where, ooh, this nerdy guy gets transported to a virtual world. I can't believe I'm praising SAO. This nerdy guy gets transported to a virtual world and he ends up saving the day because he's a really good swordsman. It's a nerdy guy gets transported to this world and he saves the day because he's nerdy. He's rewarded for liking the same pop culture stuff as the author. Not for being smarter, not for being kind or moral, but for having the right pop culture interests. And that is so dumb and so cheap and so just awful. I'm not gonna give this movie like a 2 out of a 10 because, I mean, there's really good visuals in it, but I think this is one of the worst written movies we've watched on this show. And I'm sorry for hogging the conversation.
No, that's good.
What do you have to say about this shitty movie?
Have you ever seen The Adventures of Tintin?
No.
It was also made by Spielberg. It's a fully CGI movie.
I mean, this is also almost a fully CGI movie.
There's a lot of parallels to that film and this, apart from the fact that they're both made by Spielberg and have a lot of CGI, almost entirely. I think the CGI in this film is incredible. Much, much better than Tintin. That said, I think Tintin is a better movie than this because it just has a better story. Now, that said, I agree with you 100%. This is one of the worst written movies we've ever reviewed. And that's really disheartening to say because it is a Steven Spielberg movie. I never thought in a million years I'd ever say that a Steven Spielberg movie is poorly written as this.
I mean, hey, it wasn't written by Spielberg. It was written by Zach Penn, who's actually not that bad of a writer. He created second and third X-Men movies, Incredible Hulk Adventures. So, I mean, bit hit or miss. Let's see, also worked on Last Action Hero. Hit or miss, but he's had some success. But also, it was written by the same guy who wrote the shitty book it's adapting and making slightly better.
I'm not placing the blame on Spielberg when I say that. I'm just saying he is as a filmmaker, I would imagine knows better. You know, I'm not trying to insult the guy. Point is, this movie, I almost feel like it was kind of a mistake to review it for my first viewing of it, you know? Not to say that I think we shouldn't have done this. I just think I would have had so much more enjoyment if I were just sitting back and trying to have some fun with this, instead of what I actually did, which was take notes, formulate opinions, try to follow the plot. You know, things that you're supposed to do with a good movie, and things that we have done for a year now on this show, and have watched some damn great movies in doing so. I don't know, I just feel like for my first viewing, I probably would have gotten more enjoyment out of it if I were to just watch it casually instead of just watching it to review, to pick it apart piece by piece and review it for a show. On one hand, I feel like maybe if I just watch it again in a casual setting, maybe I'll find more enjoyment. But then at the same time, I'm also like, am I really ever gonna watch this movie again? And the answer is no, probably not. I don't know. This movie is just the epitome of okay. It's visually immaculate. And yeah, that's pretty much it.
It's visually immaculate. It gave us the funny meme poster with a long leg and a really good remix of Take On Me for the trailer. And that's it.
Yep, pretty much. I thought Ben Mendelsohn was great. I thought that Mark Rylance was good.
Lena Waithe and Olivia Cooke and Ty Sheridan, they aren't. I don't think they're bad actors, but especially in the case of Sheridan, their characters aren't really interesting. Well, actually, I would say Cook and Waithe are at least interesting characters compared to Wade Watts, but the other actors in the movie, I don't think they're bad, it's just their characters are eh.
Exactly. And more to the point, every director has a style. The reason why I brought up The Adventures of Tintin earlier is because I do see a lot of parallels into that. This movie more so, but they tried. They tried with both of them, but did they succeed? Not entirely. Not really. Not a whole lot. Not. No, they did not. But I've seen The Adventures of Tintin once and it was years ago. But anyway, that's besides the point. There's certain stylistic things you expect in a Spielberg movie, especially a fun blockbuster like this. Just certain whimsical Spielberg-isms that you would expect in a movie like this, and you do get a few of them, like at the end where Nolan is being arrested and Finale punches him in the face. The way that was shot and edited and cut together with the music, especially the music, that was very much in the style of Steven Spielberg. But apart from that, and small moments in the real world like that, everything in the Oasis, anyone could have directed this. I don't feel Spielberg's presence in most of this movie. And that's the biggest shame, because he is an incredible filmmaker. I mean, what can I say that hasn't already been said about the guy? He's amazing. But this movie, they tried, and they deserve to be commended for that. But it's just the epitome of okay. And there's really not much of Spielberg's style from what I've gotten. Maybe some disagree, but I just think, like I said earlier, it didn't feel to me like Spielberg did this to make a great film. He just did it because it's a really popular book, and the only way it would have happened is if he did it. It felt like an accomplishment badge he could put on his Boy Scouts uniform, you know? It just felt like something he did just to do it, instead of making a legitimately fun, great film.
You said that this film is the epitome of okay. What does that numerically equal?
Honestly, if I look back, the movie has some good performances, great visuals, but honestly, I'm going to give it a 4 out of 10. It's fine. It's okay. It's forgettable. It's whatever.
I don't know. Six and a half. I'm so torn on this movie what score to give it, because visually it's amazing. It's really good. I want to give it not an awful score because of that, but oh god, it's just, ugh. I hate the writing in this movie. It angers me. So I don't know. 6.5 out of 10. It's not a good movie. You know, I have a feeling we'll get similar scores next week, because we're doing a bad movie, but at least it's a bad movie that has heart. Like, this is a good movie that's completely soulless. Next week, we're doing a bad movie that has a soul, at least. We're doing Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
I forgot. We filmed this episode a little out of order, so I was like, yeah, what are we doing next week? I'm really excited for Killer Clowns, man. We have a good history with that.
Killer Clowns from Outer Space. They're clowns from outer space. They do clown stuff in outer space.
And we're gonna have Raylan Stevens as a guest speaker, who guest starred in our last Airbender episode, so look forward to that.
Like, I want to have other guest stars on this show, but he's the only person who is friends with us and also likes our show and also says, hey, can I guest star? That's why he appears so much.
He and I have a fun history with this movie, and I'm really looking forward to that. I need a good pick-me-up after this episode. And I can't believe this was our first Spielberg movie, right?
Oh, God. Oh, shit, you're right. I mean,
We should do more Spielberg.
We've discussed doing Raiders of the Lost Ark or Jurassic Park, but we haven't yet. Well, we started off strong for Spielberg.
Yeah, sorry, man. We'll do more Spielberg going forward. If you liked us, you can also find us on YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Silver Age Silver Screen, where we post bonus content, updates to the show, and updates on new episodes. You can find me on YouTube at Riley Thorpe, where you can check out all of my short films, some of which have been featured in film festivals and have won awards. You can also find me on Instagram and TikTok. TikTok in particular, just a few days ago, I reached 250,000 followers. So
oh, shit.
Check out all my content.
Sometimes
on there.
I forget. You're successful online compared to me.
Casey, how about you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at JarmsCasey, JarmesCasey. Be sure to check out Double Elimination The Machine. It's a book I wrote, second in the Double Elimination series. It's about a superhero having a moral crisis and, well, I'm not going to say what happens. It's in line with the type of things we talk about on this show. You can buy it from Amazon. Well, I publish through Amazon, but also fuck Amazon. But you can't buy it anywhere else. Buy it wherever. Buy it from Amazon and then donate money to
Save the Whales.
Amazon Union stuff. I don't know. Point is, I wrote a book, Double Elimination The Machine. Buy it. It's good. It's good. I think it's good. I can't grade my own work objectively, but I like it. Anyway, we'll be back next week unless we just get so fucking tired from having to run a new video game. Ugh.
It's tiring work, man.
Yeah. As always, I'm Casey Jarms.
And I'm Riley Thorpe.
And hey, it's just a movie. Don't lose your head about it, especially not to a ladder.